Good morning, and welcome to another in our series of mini shiurim on the book of Ezra. We're learning in the merit of the IDF, Israel's emergency services, the hostages, and the injured. And we've seen the opening four sentences of Sefer Ezra. That's not bad work for a week, right? In which Cyrus, having conquered the Babylonians, tells the Jews, God has sent me to send you back to Yerushalayim to build your Beis HaMikdash anew, and he orders support for the Jews in this from their neighbors around them. What was the reaction of Jews to this? What was the emotional reaction to this? We'll see the practical reaction going forward, but what's the emotional response? So on one level, it's hope, right? Aside from the fact that they had a prophecy, which we saw from Yeshaya 44 or 45 about Cyrus sending the Jews back, we also have prophecies in Yeshaya chapter 2, Micha chapter 4, Zechariah chapter 14, and elsewhere of the nations coming to Hashem in the future. B'naharu elav kol hagoyim, the nations will scream to God. And the Jews may have seen Cyrus in that way as a fulfillment of those things. Not of Zechariah, because they wouldn't have had Zechariah yet. Zechariah is contemporary with those Jews who come back for the second Beis HaMikdash, but certainly Yeshaya and Micha. Indeed, the Sefer Yikarim, Rav Yosef Albo, notes that historically there have been those who believed that the great predictions we find in the Navi about the nations coming to God in the future were meant for the second Beis HaMikdash, were meant for Cyrus. So he gives as an example the end of Yeshaya chapter 66. All of your brethren from all of the nations are going to bring gifts to God. They understand that to refer to Cyrus commanding that the nations support the Jews as they go back to build the second Beis HaMikdash. Now, we don't actually take that view. When we read Tanakh and we read the predictions of grandeur and glory, we generally assume those are about the third Beis HaMikdash. Abarbanel on Sefer Daniel writes about this at length. But the idea that he's presenting, that one could look at Cyrus and say, all of these visions from Tanakh are coming true, is certainly possible. That's certainly a credible way to read it. So you would see hope. On the other hand, you would see fear. Wait a minute, we're actually going back. What are we going to encounter in that land? Are we going to lose whatever it is that we had in Bavel? What if God drops us because we sin, right? That happened before. What if our neighbors resent us, whether the ones here in Persia who are funding our return or the ones, you know, back in the land? Was there any fear on their part that this could be a trick by Cyrus? I don't know. We don't find a record of that. We do find some of the other fears. But you know, you have this welter of potential emotions for the Jews hearing Cyrus say, okay, time to build the Beis HaMikdash, right? Imagine that in our day, if, you know, we're not, however much we like or don't like a government, we're not living, in North America under that kind of tyranny. But imagine Jews today, you know, the government suddenly comes to us and says, okay, go back to Israel, build the Beis HaMikdash, and we're going to fund it. Another aspect of the reaction to this, consider the way that what Cyrus does here reflects poorly on our own leaders from the end of the first Beis HaMikdash and the way they failed to listen to Hashem. Look at that. The Jews didn't listen. Cyrus is the one who listened. Not unlike the rebuke we find in Shmuel Aleph, chapters 5, chapter 6, in which the Plishtim defeat the Jews in war. They take the Aron, they take the Ark, and then terrible things happen to them. They suffer some kind of an awful plague, and the result is they send the Aron back and with gifts. And there's a contrast there between the Jews who don't take the hint when bad things happen and the Plishtim, the Philistines, who do take the hint when bad things happen. There's more to be said there about the return of the Aron, not for right now. But the truth of the matter is that this contrast rubs us the wrong way. We feel uncomfortable, classically, with the fact that Cyrus listened and our leaders did not listen. And we find various passages in Medrash, in Gemara, which color the texts in a way that reduce the contrast with our leaders. Which essentially take away from the greatness that we're seeing here in Cyrus. One example, the Medrash in Vayikra Rabba, Shmini, Yud Gimel, He. Remember, the Parsha Shmini includes the lists of the non-kosher animals. So the Medrash here says, Ves HaShafan, the Shafan, right? That's some form of rabbit hair or coney, whatever the Shafan is. Zo Madai, that refers to Madai. Why? Ki Ma'alei Geirahu, because it elevates its cud. Choose its cud. Shemekaleses LaKadosh Baruch Hu, by praising Hashem. Shenemar, as the pasuk says, Ko Amar Koresh Melech Paras. Like the text says, look, Cyrus, king of Persia, did that. So the Shafan is a reference to Cyrus because he praised God. Now, it says Madai, which is the nation of Media, not Persia. That's its own discussion. But the point is, it calls him a non-kosher creature. Incidentally, it also does that with the Greeks on Arnevet, for praising God. But that's further along in the Medrash. The point being simply that we're classifying him as the Shafan. Sure, it praises God, but it doesn't have split hooves. It's still not kosher. That's the point that the Medrash is making. Also, further along, God willing, in chapter 6, we're going to see comments that the Gemara makes. The Gemara is in Rosh Hashanah, Gimel, Amud Beis, Dalet, Amud Aleph, talking about the materials that Cyrus sends for the Beis HaMikdash, about limitations that he places, about his choice of building materials, criticizing Cyrus and sort of taking him down a peg. And one wonders if this isn't a little bit of, like, we can't bear to see that Cyrus is so wonderful in contrast with our leaders. One other note, not directly relevant to the text, but worth knowing about. Medrash in Shmos Rabba, Beis Beis. When Cyrus says that we should go to HaElokim Asher Birushalayim, to the God who is in Yerushalayim. So the Medrash in Shmos Rabba says, Lo Zaza Hashchina Mitoch HaHechal. Hashem never left the site of the Beis HaMikdash. As in Divrei Hayamim, he says to Shlomo, Bahayu Einai V'Libi Sham Kol Hayamim. Hashem said, my eyes and my heart will be there always. So Hashem never abandons the site of the Beis HaMikdash. And therefore, it says in the Medrash, Bo Re'e Makoresh Omer, see what Cyrus said, El Ha'elokim Asher Birushalayim, to the God who is in Jerusalem. Amar Lahen, Cyrus said to them, Av Al Pishu Charev, even though it's in ruins, Ha'elokim Eino Zaz Misham, Hashem never left the site. Hashem was always there. And on that, Rabbi Acha comments, La'olamein hashchina zaza mikosel hama'aravi. The Shechina never left the western wall. And it references in Shir HaShirim, Hashem standing behind our wall. So that's linked here. He said, God is in Yerushalayim. God never left Yerushalayim. The western wall in that Medrash is, of course, not the western wall that we have today. The western wall that we think of today is a retaining wall of the mountain, not the wall of the Beis HaMikdash. This Medrash is talking about the wall of the Beis HaMikdash. But that's side note. Main point, Cyrus says, the God in Jerusalem, Hashem has remained there always. Okay. So what's the response? We talked about the emotional response, but what's the practical response to the declaration? Ezra chapter 1, sentence 5. Vayakumu rashei ha'avos liYehuda uBinyamin vaKohanim vaHaLeviim. The leaders of families of Yehuda, of Binyamin, of the Kohanim and Leviim, they rise up l'chol he'ir ha'elokim es rucho, to all who God awakened their spirit. The same phrase we used for Cyrus, God awakened his spirit. God awakened their spirit. La'alos livnos es beis Hashem asher b'Yerushalayim, to ascend and build the house of God in Jerusalem. V'chol sevivo sehem chizku bidehem, and all who are around them strengthen their hands. B'chle chesef b'zahav b'ruchush u'babehema u'vamigdanos, silver, gold, lots of property, animals, delicacies, you name it. Levad al kol hisnadev, aside from all who volunteered. So there are a couple of things we need to see here. First of all, notice who goes back. Yehuda, Binyamin, Kohanim, and Leviim. What about all the other tribes? So first of all, Professor Zer Kavod in the Dot Mikra edition notes that it's very interesting that they kept their tribal identity. They continued to call themselves Yehuda and Binyamin. It's remarkable that it still had value for them. Maybe this shows that they intended to come back and reclaim the land. They viewed themselves as exiled Israelis with a portion in the land, not as Babylonian Jews, not as Persian Jews. That's why they did this. But why Yehuda and Binyamin particularly? So Ibn Ezra says, of course Yehuda and Binyamin, because they're going back to Yerushalayim, and Yerushalayim is in the portion of Yehuda and Binyamin. So that's why they came back. But it's not really just them. The Medrash in Seder Olam Rabbah, Chaf Tes, notes that there are other tribes that are represented here. And you know that because if you count up, when we get the census in chapter 2, when you count up who came back from Yehuda and Binyamin, that only constitutes 30,360. And we know that there are actually 42,360. So there are another 12,000 who aren't counted in that census because they are from Sha'ar Shvatim. They're from the other tribes. The main number is Yehuda, Binyamin, Kohanim. That's who got counted in chapter 2. But there are 12,000 more from the other Shvatim. But wait a minute. Weren't the other Shvatim lost? Weren't the other tribes lost? 10 lost tribes? And the answer is no. The 10 lost tribes are not actually lost. So weren't these other Shvatim, the 10 tribes, lost? The Assyrians exiled Yisrael, those 10 tribes? So the answer is you could say no, meaning they were exiled to lands held by the Assyrians. Babel conquered Assyria, so they inherited those 10 tribes. Persia conquered Babel, and now they had them. But then you have to ask, so why do only Yehuda and Binyamin return? And that goes back to the point about it being their portion. That's one answer, is that they weren't lost at all. But also worth noting that some came back from the 10 tribes before the Beis HaMikdash was ever destroyed. There's a whole discussion in the Gemara about Yirmiyahu bringing them back and King Yoshiyahu ruling over them. And Radak in Malachim Beis 23:19 talks about them. So we had people from those other tribes who actually did come back, and those are the ones who Seder Olam Rabbah is talking about, who then came back to Israel. So Yehuda and Binyamin are the major portion, but not the only ones. Finally, it said that they sent all of this stuff, the nations around them, Levad al-Kol Hisnadev, aside from all who volunteered. So Rashi says that means that the first set of items, the first wealth we describe as coming from the neighbors, the volunteers are the ones who went themselves, meaning the Olim. And that's one take. Alternatively, Mitzudas David, Rav David Altshuler, suggests the former items are for the people who are coming back for themselves, just for their own needs, whereas his Nadev are those who volunteered for the Beis HaMikdash. When I taught this once before, so somebody there pointed out that the language of Mitnadev is parallel to the language of Nidava when they build the Mishkan. So that's what's given for the Beis HaMikdash. That's another way to read it. Okay, so there's been a positive response to Cyrus's decree, and what we have to see next, God willing, next week, is Cyrus returning the vessels of the Beis HaMikdash. Have a restful Shabbos.